Good morning, members. The call of meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order. And if you didn't get any, Representative Quam bought bagels, but they're on the fifth floor. And I'd like to welcome everybody today. Let's begin with entertaining a motion to approve the minutes from the April 6th meeting. Is there a motion? Representative
Simonson,
thank you. I was thinking Eric. Representative Simonson moves to approve the minutes from the April 6th meeting. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from the April 6th meeting signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. Okay, with that, we will move. Representative Freiberg is here with his bill, House File 3118. And Representative Dabney moves to entertain House File 3118 and lay it over after the discussion. So, Representative Freiberg, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence as well as the committee's for hearing my bill today. The bill was, the idea for the bill, I should say, was brought to me by a constituent who's a disabled veteran. I'm sure as everybody on this committee knows, disabled veterans are entitled to certain property tax benefits. However, when they move in the middle of the year, under current law, those benefits stay with the house, or the property, I should say, that they're living at until the end of the year, even if the purchaser of the house is a non-veteran, as was the case with the person who purchased my constituent's property. And similarly, the disabled veteran does not get the advantage of the exclusion at the new property. At the new property until the next year when they can reapply for it. So my constituent was kind of upset by this. I worked with Steve Hines, who's staffing your committee, to come up with bill language just to make it so that there's a property tax abatement issued at the new property so that the disabled veteran could take advantage of the bill of the exclusion at the new property. My constituent would have liked to have been here to testify. She's out of town caring for a sick relative. However, there is, I believe in your packet, there's a letter from her sort of explaining her situation. There's also a letter from the Disabled American Veterans of Minnesota in support of the bill in your packet. So that's pretty much what the bill does, and I can keep it short out of respect for the committee's time.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg, you'd like to add the A1 amendment to the bill as well?
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, I would.
Representative Dabney would move the A1 amendment to House File 3118. Any discussion on the A1 amendment, members? Representative Freiberg, quickly describe that, if you would.
It makes some technical changes and conforms to language that was sent over to the Senate. I know, I think Mr. Hines, I think, could probably do a better job of explaining it than I could if the committee would like a description of it.
Okay, discussion on the A1 amendment, members. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 amendment is adopted. Discussion on the bill as amended, members. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Freiberg, I've only bought two homes, but it's a negotiation process. You know, that we need a new roof on the new place. Let's negotiate the cost of who pays for the new roof that's needed or whatever. Why not simply have the value of the property tax exclusion part of the negotiations between the buyer and the seller? You're going to get a $1,500 property tax benefit here. Let's talk.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney. Well, the state has decided as a matter of policy that if a person has served their country and gotten disabled in the process, that they are entitled to this property tax benefit. To me, you know, I suppose you could do it that way, but to me it just if, as long as we've made that policy decision as a state, it seems to make sense to me that it should continue, it should apply, you know, even if a person moves in the middle of the year. It, you know, they should be, and if they're a disabled veteran, they've served our country, they should be entitled to this property tax benefit and shouldn't have to rely on negotiations with a home buyer to account for it. So it just seems consistent with state law to me to do it the way this bill does.
Representative Devitt.
Thank you. We're just thinking out loud.
Thank you both. Other questions, members? Discussion? Seeing none, any final comments? Representative Freiberg?
No, I appreciate your time, and I know my constituent appreciates it very much as well.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Anybody from the audience that would like to testify? Mr. May. Welcome, Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, retired Hennepin County Assessor, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. When House File 3118 was first introduced, we certainly agreed with it. What it simply did is change that July 1st date to a December 1st date and a December 15th application, and that would make it standardized with other homestead applications. And we were perfectly okay with that, and we let Representative Freiberg know that we were okay with that. But the bill has considerably expanded since that time. As you know, taxes are always levied 1 year and collected in the following year. So with the December 1st date, any veteran applying for this benefit would qualify and get it in the following year, and that's the way the taxes work. And as far as going the other way, when someone sells a home, whether it's homestead, whether it's a veteran's exclusion, whatever it might be, those taxes are already extended, and they are in existence for the rest of the year to the new buyer, whether they're going to homestead it, whether they're going to rent it, whatever they might do. So there's really, it adds a lot of administrative difficulty to try to correct those taxes in the middle of the year. So we would support the bill in its original form that changes the application date to December 1st with the December 15th deadline, but we would not support the changes to the bill as we see them now. And as we've always stated in the past, we certainly agree with the veterans' benefits, but we would support a statewide program for this instead of on the local property tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May, members? Anyone else who would, thank you, Mr. May, anyone else who would like to comment or discuss the bill? Yes. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. And
I'm Ralph Rickson. I'm the city assessor for City of Minnetonka Beach in Hennepin County, Minnesota. I wanted to just make a comment about a person I had apply for the veterans credit and never got, was able to get this credit because he was not, he wouldn't give me proof. He was, had mental issues, and he was afraid to give up his information. Well, his family finally got power of attorney, and they gave me the proof. So he had applied originally in 2008, and they got the proof in 2000, this year, last year, in 15. So we tried to abate 1 year, and of course it had an absolute deadline of July 1st, and so we couldn't even abate 1 year back on the fellow. And I think that's something that's missing from this. I just wanted to throw that out because I had the original application, but yet because of the law, he wasn't even able to go back 1 year on it. We were able to get, he's on now for this payable year of 2016, but I think that's something that's overlooked in it. And I do, I also agree with what Mr. May had said on this too. I think it's good, but it goes a little too deep on the paperwork end of it. So that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Members, questions for Mr. Erickson? Thank you. Anyone else who would like to discuss the bill? Hearing none, the chair lays over House File 3118. Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you.
And members, related to 3118, Representative Freiberg did mention there's two letters in your packet, so just drawing your attention to those again. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Fenton. Is Representative Fenton here? Here she is. House File 2820. Representative Erickson moves House File 2820 be laid over, be entertained and laid over. Welcome, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 2820 is a bill to move Washington County Housing and Redevelopment Authority to a community development agency. Basically, this would allow the county and cities to work together to retain and attract business. And in an effort of brevity, I'm going to turn it over to our Commissioner Fran Miron to talk more about this bill.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Mr. Miron, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fran Miron, Washington County Commissioner. I live in the city of Hugo.
Welcome.
Appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. I indicated I live in the city of Hugo. I actually served as mayor of the city of Hugo for 16 years. Served on the city council 4 years prior to that, and chaired, actually created and chaired the EDA during that period of time while serving as mayor. Washington County would like to take a more active role in economic development. We've been working collaboratively with cities on this since the fall of 2013. We actually have garnered supporting resolutions from our cities with EDAs. I could go through the list if you choose. I also have supporting resolutions from cities without separate EDAs within Washington County. And then we have a number of cities that still hope to adopt resolutions. I believe there's four or five that are still considering resolutions of adopting those for support. The county board wants to add value to economic development efforts through countywide programming and partnerships through staff at our HRA, our Housing and Redevelopment Authority. We want to promote the assets of the county better. We want to work with cities and townships to offer programs that help retain businesses and attract new businesses. And we want to strengthen partnerships with the existing businesses we have within our communities. Ultimately, the goal is to retain the county's quality of life and expand its tax base.
Thank you, Mr. Miron. And please introduce yourself, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Melissa Taphorn. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of the Washington County HRA.
Welcome, Ms. Taphorn. I didn't want to say your name wrong, so.
Appreciate it. Thank you. The Washington County HRA was established through a special law, and so this bill is amending that enabling law, and it simply adds economic development authority powers to the HRA. So we're not creating a separate entity, a separate EDA. We're just combining those two authorities, the HRA authorities and the EDA authorities, into one existing entity. And then particular to your committee here, we are waiving the right to that second levy. So we could levy for HRA under the HRA statutes, and we could levy under the EDA statutes, but we're waiving that second levy and just keeping it under the HRA levy. Right now, our levy is set each year on an annual basis based on the budget needs of the agency, and that is approved by our HRA board, which is appointed by the county commissioners, and then the county board approves that final levy. And we have been consistently under the maximum amount that we could levy. So we're at about 90% in the funds levied in 2016.
Thank you, Ms. Taphorn. Representative Fenton.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I also would note, I believe it is in your pocket, that the Department of Revenue issued a zero-based fiscal note on this initiative.
Thank you. Questions, members? I have one, and I don't know who can answer it, but Article 2, Subdivision 5 on line 3.23 changes the way or provides a special path around tax forfeited land. Can someone talk about that and what that means? Mr. Miron?
Ms. Chair, Taphorn. Yep, Mr. Chair and committee members, Subdivision 5 on the offering of tax forfeited lands. Right now, the way the county offers tax forfeited properties is to look at departments within the county and then offer them to cities. And if there isn't a public purpose or public need for those tax forfeited lands, they would go to auction. Right now, the HRA is in that latter part, and we're asking to be considered as a county department, and so we would be offered earlier than the auction.
So it moves HRA up one step.
And
front of the line.
Well, and it's still a may. It's written as a may. So the county board would decide whether or not that was offered to the HRA or the new CDA.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this could be Ms. Taphorn or Commissioner Muren. Is this policy that you're bringing forward, this change, something that would work in many areas or other areas, or has it already been started? Did you model this after another county that wanted to merge their HRA with a community development agency? Could you comment on that? Because, Mr. Chair, this might be, you know, a statewide policy change that we'd want to consider allowing counties to merge, or development authorities to merge with counties.
Mr. Muren?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Erickson, actually we're following the same path as Dakota, Carver, and Scott counties, and Anoka County is have a similar authority.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, so Commissioner Muren, how about in more rural counties? To what extent do you think this could work for them? Because you've mentioned counties that have had a lot of growth and expansion, and so obviously there is, you know, Housing and Redevelopment Authority that's active, but how about in more rural counties?
Commissioner Muren.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I actually find that that's where it would work extremely well. And what we're finding in Washington County is the cities, particularly in the northern part of Washington County, which is the area that I represent as a county commissioner, are relatively rural. And those communities have very limited resources with respect to economic development. In some cases, they have economic development authorities that have just started. They're in their infancy. And they are the communities that are welcoming this with open arms. You know, cities like Woodbury certainly have indicated their support, but they have much more in the way of resources to support economic development than what the smaller communities. So I think this effort would probably work well in rural Minnesota as well as our suburban area within Washington County.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too just have a couple of questions with regard to clarifying exactly what this would do. You know, I guess my question is, it appears that under the language of the bill, you would have then countywide levy authority to make specific improvements within a specific community. Am I getting that correctly?
Commissioner Muren?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you are. That is characteristic of the law here. It would allow us, we actually have levy authority with our HRA now. We could choose, as Melissa indicated, to levy for the EDA. We're not choosing to do that. We're going to maintain a single levy in that. But I also want to call your attention and to the bill itself on page 3 or section 3.30, that all of this is going to be subject to the approval of the governing body or the city that or township that we're working within. So Washington County is a conservative county. We watch our pennies as close as you do here at the legislature. And
that's not very close, Commissioner Muren.
You know, we're very cautious, but we're going to be working collaboratively with the cities on any funding approach that we use here.
Thank you. Representative Fenton?
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus. And I would add that in this bill, the initiative, it actually starts and stops with the municipalities. So we changed language in this bill working with our cities to make sure that our municipalities, townships, have the final authority for projects that occur in their areas.
Ms. Taphorn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, I'm not sure if this is part of your question. So the levy that we can do is countywide and even across the county. We cannot add an additional city-specific levy. So I just want to clarify that.
Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess one of my concerns is, and we see this happening in other governing bodies over the metropolitan region, is that sometimes you get the higher levels of government kind of strong-arm communities into doing things because you have community scores and different metrics that measure your cooperation with overarching governments. And so as a past mayor, I find that sometimes frustrating to have that coercion ever present over a community that either you play ball or you're not going to see cooperation in other areas. And a lot of times with regard to proposed projects, obviously the city government, you're saying, has the authority to accept or reject, but oftentimes it's the other leverage that oftentimes circumvents the will of the people within a community. I guess I would have some concerns over that.
Thank you. Other questions, members? One question. I know Ms. Taphorn and I talked about this yesterday, onto that same discussion. So the focus is on the government, on the county government, the city government, and we'll come in if it's okay with you to help. But what about the taxpayer? So is there redundancy potentially for the taxpayer if there is agreement between the county and the city? And I'm a taxpayer, and I'm saying, okay, I'm paying the county property tax for this service, and I'm paying the city property tax for this service. Any discussion about that? Ms. Taphorn?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we did have this conversation yesterday, or you raised this issue, and thought about that overnight. And the Economic Development Authority activities that the county CDA would undertake are really a more broad spectrum, so they're not things that would be undertaken by the city. And so I think that it does benefit the residents of all of the cities in Washington County. And similarly, the state has the DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, that also does economic development authorities on an even broader level. And so we're kind of looking at that. And yes, the residents are going to have a city, whether it be in the city general levy or the CDA's general levy. But neither the county level or the city, none of the cities with EDAs in Washington County have an EDA-specific special benefit levies.
Thank you. Commissioner Murren?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your point, Representative, having come from a local governing body, that was a significant concern of mine and other members of our county board, because as you well know, people in those seats change, and this law won't necessarily change over time unless it's brought to the governing bodies at the state level. We wanted to make sure that we included language within this bill to prevent that strong arming that you were talking about. And if you look in at particularly subdivision 2, 4.3 all the way through 4.17, we incorporate language there that really protects the authority of the cities, that the project must be authorized by resolution of the governing body of the statutory or home rule charter city or township with respect to each identified parcel of property, and it goes on. So there's very strong language within this bill, and it was done deliberately to prevent the type of concern that you had, because we shared similar concerns in Washington County.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other questions, members? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some experience with this in Scott County, and we did the same thing for the additional powers that come with the CDA authority. The HRA levy was always a question in my mind, as it is in, should be in most commissioners' minds, because you're actually taking taxpayer money and subsidizing rental property generally against sometimes private ownership. And I think that's a discussion that needs to keep occurring. So I don't think, from my perspective, that this particular broadening of powers would have an adverse effect on anything that's going on now as far as taxpayers, but it does sometimes bring up the higher question that's being raised here of some of the levy authority of HRAs and what's going on. And that's not to say that HRAs aren't providing a valuable function, but I applaud the efforts to be looking at this, and I think any county that looks at this needs to have those thorough discussions before just entering into it, because it could lead to additional levy authority if it's not handled properly and strategically. So my feeling is I have a comfort level with the way this is being approached, but as far as broadening the authority generally, I think that would need a much larger discussion to make sure that indeed we aren't giving that levy authority and then all of a sudden it just gets used rather than really strategically controlled.
Thank you. Commissioner Murren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel. Discussion again that has occurred at Washington County at that level. We have a good budgeting process. We work closely with the AHRA as they develop their budget. I actually serve on the Housing and Redevelopment Authority along with a number of good appointees that we have serving Washington County in that capacity. That budget receives considerable review and discussion throughout the budget process, but certainly as we vote to approve that budget, we scrutinize it significantly, and we have been in the past. Melissa can share with you that we are not a pushover government with respect to the budgets from these various budgeting authorities. So.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Hearing none, would anyone else like to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Representative Fenton?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members, and thank you for listening to this bill. This is a complete bipartisan support. I was very honored to have every single member that serves in the House with me, regardless side of the aisle, for Washington County sign on and agree to the terms of this bill. So thank you, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you. With that, the chair lays over House File 2820. Thank you. Next, we will hear House File 3828. Representative Anderson, are you ready, sir? He's always at the ready. Representative Anderson moves House File 3828 to be laid over. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members. I thought we needed to have a discussion of buffers at least once in this committee this year. And in full disclosure, I'm a farmer. I represent a heavy agriculture district, but I don't have any ditches on my property, so it doesn't affect me personally. And you may wonder, what's the big deal of just having a 16 and a half foot strip taken off your field if you have a ditch going through your field? But in total here in the state, the numbers we're hearing are this is going to affect about 110,000 acres statewide. So it is, in the aggregate, it's a pretty large number of acres affected that farmers are going to be turning into, in many cases, from productive farmland into a perennial grass buffer strip, which we certainly hope will impact state water quality and do good things for the state. And my thought all along with the buffer bill was that if this is going to benefit the state, I think the state should step up and help pay for some of the costs associated with establishing these buffer strips throughout Minnesota. And in my research, Mr. Chair, on how different counties handle ditches and buffer strips and things, I found that there's a lot of different ways it's done. Some counties currently exempt the width of a ditch going through a farm field. Renville County, for example, automatically deducts a 60-foot wide strip accounting for the ditch through a field. So in that case, the situation of the property tax has been taken care of. But a lot of counties do it differently. And the fiscal note here really surprises me in that the large number that for a two-year biennium, it's about $15 million of property tax that would be affected by if the state totally paid the property taxes on these buffer strip requirements. But what could happen, members, is that if counties would simply reduce the classification of this land from highly productive land, and I'm just using a figure of, say, an average property tax of $50 an acre on some highly productive land, and if it's reduced down to waste would be the category of the grassland, and say the tax on that were $5 an acre, we're looking at a reduction of about 90% in the taxes on that land, and that's going to result in a shift to the other taxpayers in the county. If the county just goes ahead and reduces the assessment value of the buffer strip, and then that is passed along to the rest of the county. So I think there's an issue here, and I'm not expecting that we're going to pass a $60 million bill to pay this. I mainly wanted to draw attention to the fact that this is going to have an impact on not only farmers, but on counties, townships, and school districts as well. And Mr. Chair, I think I have a couple of testifiers that want to come down and say a few words on the bill, if you would allow that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Busselman. Welcome, Mr. Busselman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Busselman. I'm with the Minnesota Farm Bureau. We support House File 3828 and the concept of providing landowners a tax credit for their property taxes and property taken from them to be put into buffers. Also, taking the approach of sub D3 and other provisions of the bill, not only does this avoid the transfer of the lost property taxes to others in the taxing district, but it also keeps local taxes, local government and school districts from being harmed from revenue loss. There's not been a lot of meaningful consideration given to landowners impacted by the mandated requirement to take their property out of production and plant it to a perennial vegetative buffer. At least by this bill, we're covering the property taxes for those areas, which seems appropriate as an action to take, in our opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Questions for Mr. Busselman? Is Mr. Peterson here?
Yeah.
Welcome, Mr. Peterson. It's the other Mr. Peterson. Welcome.
Yes, I'm the other Mr. Peterson. He's not my son, Mr. Chairman. a lot of people make that mistake. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we're here to testify in support of the bill that's in front of you today, House File 3828. I will have some brief remarks, and I will also stand for questions. I want to thank Representative Anderson right off for authoring this riparian buffer property tax reduction. I think it identifies enough appropriations for the tax release provision. Minnesota Farmers Union does support the bill, and I think within the bill, having read it, I believe there's enough protection to the school districts and adequate direction to the county auditors and also to the Commissioner of Revenue for the appropriation that's needed. The appropriation from the Clean Water Fund is also a benefit to the goals of clean water throughout the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions, members, for the author or the two testifiers so far? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Rep. Anderson, for bringing this forward. I don't think the bill goes far enough. I think that farmers being forced to take their land out of production in the interest of clean water, if the state doesn't condemn and take the property and compensate it for them, they should at least pay an annual payment for that land. It's still private property, and that's a basic tenet of our constitutional rights and our free market principles. So that's my thoughts.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, I kind of share the same thought as Representative Hertas. We took the farmer's land. It violates the Constitution. If we were going to pay an easement payment on these, how would that compare to the $15 million that you have in the bill to pay off the property taxes? Would that be a greater amount? if you look at kind of past easement purchases, had you looked into that at all?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. I talked to the assessor in Martin County yesterday. That's on the southern Minnesota border. And their land value is down there for the top land are about $9,000 an acre. So if you, and he said that what they do as well is they will pay the easement type thing to a farmer when their ditches are redetermined and to put into to a buffer strip. I don't have numbers on comparing the costs, but again, you have such a wide range of land prices in the state, and most of our ditches are, I think, in southern Minnesota, where land prices are higher. I would guess that the cost of that would be much higher than paying the taxes. And a concern expressed about that, if the state actually pays for the land or pays an easement, questions arise about access to the public. If the state pays that, do they actually buy the land? And then would there be access issues for people to be on the land? So some kind of look at that with a little bit of concern. So I thought this was at least something we could do to help with that loss of productivity to that land.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So given your comments and Representative Hertas's and Representative Anderson's, I guess I'm wondering what the purpose of Subdivision 3 in the bill is, 2.1 to 2.3, saying that the assessor can't reduce the value of land due to restrictions, due to buffer restrictions. I guess I'm thinking if the land is less valuable because use has been taken away in some way, why wouldn't the assessor then be able to reduce the value? Maybe I'm just betraying my lack of knowledge here, but...
Representative Anderson.
Well, I think if the assessor reduces the value, the property tax becomes less. And then again, we have that shift. Whereas if the assessed value remains high at what it is right now, that state paid credit then would be a higher total. Again, that example of a $50 an acre tax on the land if it's assessed at its current value.
Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But so why leave it artificial? If the land has less value because of the buffer, if that's what the claim is being made, then why leave the value artificially high and then give a credit? Why not just set the value at the proper value? And then if the landowner has less valuable land, then just have the property tax be based on the actual value of the land. Why prohibit setting the value correctly?
Because that would result in a shift. The taxes paid then would be less on that land, which would be shifted to the other taxpayers in the county.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess because what I'm trying to figure out here is this is land that, as it says in 1.12, this is land continuing to provide income to the landowner, and then it's going to be a 100% credit. And again, I may just be betraying my lack of knowledge about riparian buffers, which is not my area of expertise. But I'm trying to understand that if it's still providing income, et cetera, what the purpose of the 100% credit would be at that point.
Representative Anderson.
It wouldn't be providing income. It would be a perennial grass strip left along the edge of a ditch to protect water quality.
So the argument, Representative Pinto, I mean, you could still hay it and cut hay off of it or bedding or whatever you would do, but you couldn't use the full value for... You couldn't dig it up and put it in a corn or something like that. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the point is, so it would provide some income, but not as much income as it did before.
I think that's probably accurate. Representative Anderson?
Well, I would say, too, with a 16-foot strip, it's pretty difficult to get in there to hay it. Mm-hmm. If we're talking a 50-foot wide strip, that would be more accessible. But a 16-foot strip, you'd have to have all self-propelled equipment. Be pretty difficult to hay it.
Probably run over some crops getting there, Representative Anderson. Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair, just a final point. So it does, though, as the bill is written, it does require that the land continue to provide some kind of income. And if it doesn't provide any income, then this doesn't apply at all based on how it's written in 1.12, just to point that out.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
No comment.
Representative Quam. Mr. Hines first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I think that the language you're referring to says that the land that gets this credit can't be enrolled in a conservation program that provides income. So it can't be in that. Yeah, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on to this point about getting the assessors involved in decreasing, I think earlier testimony at a meeting, we saw that directions in state law to assessors is not necessary, to exempt value is not necessarily implemented, and we had a good debate about you know, that with, I think it was storage facilities.
And that's coming back to a committee.
Right, right. So, you know, frankly, I prefer this route than something that may or may not actually get implemented by the local assessor.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that this would be a good use of our constitutional amendment. Under the wording, clean water was first in that amendment, so why aren't we reimbursing based on that language?
Mm-hmm. For some of us, that question is rhetorical, Representative Erickson. Thank you. Representative Anderson, any comments on that?
Yeah, I agree. Although clean water fund, people are cautious with those funds as well. The projects, good projects funded with that. And so, yeah. I would agree. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Hertas, then Dabney, then you, Akeem.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to respond to Representative Pinto's reference to the acreage. In terms of lowering the value, I mean, that would just ignore the income approach of that land. And so, you know, just lowering the value and having the benefit there ignores the fact that the farmer could be using it for highest and best use. So, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward in the light of day. You'll recall that last year the majority here pushed through an environment bill without working cooperatively with the governor, who actually has to sign bills for them to become law, if we all go back to how a bill becomes law. But the majority pushed through an environment bill that was unacceptable to the governor, forced his hand to veto it, and by doing so, forced the discussion of buffers and other issues behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Public policy should be made in the light of day, not behind closed doors where the public doesn't get to see, doesn't get to understand, doesn't get to appreciate what's going on, who's doing what, and why. So I just want to thank you for doing this in the light of the day where the public can know and understand this proposal. Thank you.
And we do everything in the light of day here, Representative Dabney, in the Property Tax Committee. If we could only get video service down here. So Representative Yelwakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is a question. Yeah, it's a question for the author, just a clarifying one. So once the landowner makes initial application, the credit is applied every year, but the land only has to prove every 3 years that the buffer is being maintained. Why was that a choice of yours?
Representative Anderson.
Well, it's assumed that these buffers are permanent and are going to be there for a long time and just not have to go in every year to say, yes, my buffer strip is still there. And there would be up to the farmer's honesty to maintain the buffer, and assuming that they would.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so if there was a change in ownership, or if there, would that trigger a new application?
Representative Anderson?
I would say yes. Yeah, when the land would change hands, yes, that would... I would assume, yes.
Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair, is that something that we should have in statute, or is that already kind of assumed in other statute? Maybe that's for council.
Mr. Hines, thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joaquin, I think that there's a provision in here that says that a new owner has to apply, but I am not seeing it right here. On line... 1.19, unless further talking about applications, unless use or ownership of the land has changed.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Ewing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Council. As always, you've caught something that I didn't catch when I read this at about 11 o'clock last night. And one other question then. What happens if the landowner within those 3 years that they're having to report changes the use of that land and decides maybe to start haying on it? So... would they still possibly be able to be receiving the credit when they're still getting income? or if it gets placed in a conservation tax credit program.
Representative Anderson.
If they pay it, that would not affect their credit, to my understanding. And if they put it into a continuous CRP program, that would change this. They would, that would become a tax producing, because that's an income when they go to CRP. And that would put them back into a paying taxes on it.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just concerned if you have that three-year window, then maybe they could have a year where it, or is it, is it a look back? If it's, if it's triggered and it's put in a CRP, then would they, would the assessor or the program look back and then take back the credit?
Representative Anderson.
We're getting into the weeds here, but yeah, I would say that there would be a mechanism where, where this would be caught and looked at and the proper assessments would be made.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, also the same language we're just looking at also talks about unless use or ownership has changed. So I think you could argue that that would maybe encompass putting it into a conservation program.
Okay, good discussion analysis of the weeds. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just seems like it'd be a little cumbersome for the assessors, but I'm sure Mr. May may be up here to talk about it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I actually agree with the concept of the bill. I like it. I think, you know, some of the things that I hear about from constituents in my district, which is not ag-related necessarily, but they understand that there's, you know, there's going to be a cost with complying with clean water, you know, going forward in order to make these improvements. There's obviously a cost, but, and not to belabor the point about Subdivision 3, but I think what I heard you say is that part of the purpose, if not the purpose, at least part of the purpose for Subdivision 3 is to avoid shifting the cost onto other property taxpayers within the county. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
And
yeah.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. So, and I just want to make it clear, I think that what I'm seeing in the documents here is that if this were to be signed into law, that over the course of a biennium, the cost is around $15 million, give or take. Yeah. And just to be clear for the public, that That is a cost that the entire state then would absorb one way or another. But I actually like the bill. I just want to make it clear that, you know, there is a cost to this, and I think that we as a state should step up together and make sure that we pay for that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to get out of the dark, and since we don't have video coverage, we do have audio. If someone was listening to Representative Devine's comments, it was not done in the dark of night in the smoky-filled hallways, in the, you know, not in the clear of day. It was done with the DFL Senate, the bill, the buffer bill last year, in full disclosure and transparency, and all was welcome to comment and to be a participant in that discussion of compromise. So it was always in the light of day.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Other questions, members? Okay, Representative Anderson, any closing comments? We have the weeds analyzed, and I'm sorry, Mr. May wants to comment on the bill. I should ask if anyone else would like to talk. Thank you, Mr. May, for being assertive, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom May for the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We fully understand the issues, and we have no problem with the concepts that are in the bill. What we are opposed to, of course, is the administrative burden that it'll put on assessors. Of course, our assessors are trained to value property, and so this bill kind of goes in the opposite direction. It adds an administrative program, and it takes away the ability of assessors to value property, and so we would be opposed to Subdivision 3, being that it varies from market value, and that we would much prefer to value these properties based on their restricted use in that regard. So we would, I guess, like to work with the agricultural agencies and Representative Anderson and find a solution that maybe isn't as administratively burdensome and still gets the job done.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May? Anyone else that would like to comment or discuss the bill? Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, committee, representative, I'm Rolf Erickson. I'm also, in addition to being city assessor,
of Minnetonka Beach. I'm city assessor of several areas that have agricultural properties. And I only want to bring up three small points here. The first one is it seems to me here that we're creating another property tax classification to add to our 54 to 57 or whatever we have now, rather than looking at ways to cut back. The second thing that I would like to bring up is that this law, from what I understand, affects buffer land bordering public waters. And I watched in testimony at the Natural Resource Committee where a gentleman from White Bear Lake asked if his Metro Lake property would be possibly considered under this bill. And the answer from the chair of the committee was that it would. It could be, or it would. So my I guess what I'm saying on this is that this is just discussing agricultural property. And from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, it's optional for watersheds who are non-elected bureaucrats to decide if they're going to have a buffer zone in areas, but it could possibly be on Metro Lakes. And I just wanted to voice my concern on that. Number one, again, we're making an extra property class that's hard to administer. And the second thing is that this may be opening the door to an awful lot more than just this bill. So
thank you, Mr.
That's my comments on it.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Representative Anderson, any discussion on those items?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I hadn't thought about that. I think the intent of the buffer language was to buffer areas that had water moving through their ditches most of the season or part of the season. So as far as wetlands or lakes, I had not thought of that. And there are shoreland exemptions and such, so we'll have to look into that. I appreciate the concern you raise, but it's not my intention to exempt Metro Lakes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to comment on the bill? Hearing none, the chair does lay over House File 3828. And House File 3806, Representative Sanders. Representative Sanders, welcome. With House File 3828, Representative Kosnick moves House File 3806. Representative Kosnick moves House File 3806 to be laid over. Representative Sanders, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Members, thank you for giving us the time today and your consideration. I'm excited to be here today with Representative Moran, and as well, it's her birthday today, so we should all say happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Representative Moran.
Thank you. She could think of no better place
to
be than property taxes.
There's nobody volunteering.
today, Mr. Chair and members, we have a bill in front of you and one provision in particular that is a property tax exemption, or really more of a continuation of a property tax exemption that has been desolate and dormant for over a decade, that will allow, if we pass this through, will allow a first-class, world-class soccer stadium to be built, along with other private businesses and entities that will help grow, develop, and revitalize an area of St. Paul and Major League Soccer in the state of Minnesota. Soccer is very important to both of our districts, to my district especially, as far as amateur soccer goes and youth soccer, home of the National Sports Center. You know, we have some of the world's largest amateur sporting competitions that take place in Blaine, Minnesota. Really a crown jewel of Minnesota. I mean, one of the reasons that many folks come to Minnesota, that come to Blaine, are for sports and for soccer. And spending time there. I'm grateful that the team has decided that we'll continue, the Major League team will continue to practice and will continue to be involved with youth sports and youth soccer, the National Sports Center, but also proud and to work with Representative Moran to help bring this world-class facility to St. Paul with the birth of a Major League Soccer team. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to quickly turn things over to Representative Moran.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Moran, welcome.
Well,
and happy birthday again.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
We won't guess how many.
Let's not go there. Mr. Chair and members, again, thank you for this moment here. I am very excited to be partnering with Representative Sanders to bring professional soccer to Minnesota. In March of 2015, the ownership group of Minnesota United was provisionally awarded an expansion franchise to bring professional soccer to Minnesota. And in October of 2015, announced they intended to build their professional soccer stadium in St. Paul. The proposed stadium will be built in the Midway neighborhood at Snelling and University and will hold approximately 20,000 fans. The stadium will be the first of its kind built in Minnesota, and construction of the stadium is estimated to cost about $150 million, which will be paid by the team. So again, I am excited about what this can do for my district and the engagement that would happen with professional soccer in the community.
And Mr. Chair, again, so Section 2 of the bill that you have is a property tax exemption for the stadium site. These property tax exemptions are very common and very common for us to do, especially when we're talking about redevelopment opportunities. And I think that this is really important for us to do. Again, this site, as the overwhelming majority of it, has been under a property tax exemption. It currently is. You know, if we don't do anything, this land is going to continue to have a property tax exemption for it sitting desolate and dormant. So I think this is a great opportunity to redevelop this area and revitalize Major League Soccer in the state of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, if we move on to the next testifier, I'd like to introduce the mayor of the city of St. Paul, Mayor Coleman.
I think that would, thank you, Representative Sanders. I think that would be a good quick question from Mr. Hines on the bill. Does Mr. Hines, so if the primary use changes, what happens under the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the language says that the exemption applies if only as to the extent that it is used for the purpose of providing the stadium for Major League Soccer. So I think any other use would render the exemption not to be in place.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, Mayor Coleman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here, especially to celebrate Representative Moran's birthday as well. I forgot to bring a cake, but hopefully we can bring
no,
a soccer
No singing,
stadium.
Mayor. No singing.
I'm saving that for Min Roast on Friday. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is an incredibly unique opportunity. In all the conversations that have occurred over the years relative to professional sports stadiums, this is the very first time that anyone has come to you to say that the private ownership group of the team will pay for all costs of the constructions of the stadium. I believe you have before drawings, renderings of what that stadium would look like. It is an absolutely beautiful facility. On a piece of land right now, as Representative Sanders has said, is dreadfully underused and has been so for a long time. It has been off the tax rolls for over 50 years as part of the old bus barn site, then the staging area for light rail, and now sitting empty as a brownfield that is, quite frankly, very, very difficult to redevelop. We've taken some shots at it before. But we think, absent this project, not only will we be a long time coming and redeveloping the site and doing anything that might potentially increase the taxable value in that area, but certainly the proposal for redevelopment of the entire Midway site as well as development in the surrounding area, we think would not happen but for the fact that this stadium would be constructed. I want to start say from the outset that the intent is that the private ownership group does pay for all construction costs. upon completion of the stadium, this would be turned over and owned by the City of St. Paul. It would be a municipally owned facility, like other stadiums, but we do need the language in the tax bill in order to continue the tax exemption that currently exists on the piece of property. This is an exciting opportunity. Some of you may have seen the article in the Twin Cities paper, or I'm sorry, the St. Paul paper this morning that talked about the fact that there are a lot of folks that are already moving into the area, buying houses in the Midway area, considering looking at living in the Midway area because they're excited about soccer. Soccer is the world's game. The fan base for soccer is very, very different than other sports. People want to be close to the stadium. They want to participate in activities around the stadium. We know that this will help the bars and restaurants in the nearby area. I like to joke that Danny O'Gara, I think, is already building a wing on his house in anticipation of this. But the fact of the matter is, we know that this will be very, very catalytic for that entire area, the redevelopment of that area. There have been some drawings and some proposals from the current owner of the Midway Shopping Center, Rick Burdoff, who, on what he has shown, would increase the taxable value of that entire parcel, the 34-acre site, even including the continuation of the tax exemption, would increase the taxable value somewhere in the 13 to 14 times multiples of its existing value. It would include retail, it would include potential theaters, office and housing on the site. We think that this is an exciting opportunity to revitalize an area of the city that is called Midway for a reason. It's really the center of the Twin City area and the population base. If you lay out the maps of where people live in this area, this is smack dab in the middle of the bullseye, and yet it has been underutilized. So we're very excited for the opportunity, very appreciative of the ownership group that is willing to step forward and invest their own money in the stadium, not asking for public dollars beyond this tax exemption. And we think that absent this, we wouldn't have the catalyst to redevelop that area and really get it to be the point to the point where it should be. So with that, I'd thank you and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mayor Coleman. Questions for the mayor? Members? Representative Hertog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders and Mayor Coleman. In understanding this, and we're asking for a property tax exemption for the long term, and the fact that it's going to be turned over to the city anyway, which would be a tax-exempt owner, why are we having this discussion about tax exemption for the property tax?
Mr. Chair, Mayor Coleman. Representative, this would come under the language relative to private use, and this could be, fall under the consideration that this is a private facility for the soccer team, and absent the language, we believe that it would make it taxable even if it was municipally owned.
Representative Hertos?
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mayor. What percentage of St. Paul is already off the tax rolls, St. Paul property? Because I know it's significant, and we've had some of these conversations in the past on other acts.
Thank you.
Mayor Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's approximately 33%. It's about, we consider it about a third between universities, state government, churches, etc.
Government's big in St. Paul, Mayor.
Well, you know, we do appreciate you coming and spending money in the city.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually want to build on Representative Hurtado's question. Just ask, Mr. Mayor, can you talk about the public use of the stadium itself besides, I mean, the team itself will use it, but I gather that the sense is that area colleges and community groups and others, can you just talk about what the expectation is for that and what's being done to sort of be sure that expectation will be followed through?
Mayor Coleman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. Dr. McGuire is here, and I think he can speak more eloquently to that than I can, but it is certainly contemplated in our use agreement that this would be an opportunity for high school teams to participate there. We're thinking about some of the tournaments, like in the Hmong Sports Tournament might have its championship game here. The Somali and Oromo communities are having similar tournaments. Potentially that could be used here. The state high school championship we would anticipate would be perfect for this. So there will be other uses and opportunities for people other than the team to use it. The interesting thing about the soccer season is it starts early and ends late. I think it goes basically April through December, which is one of the appeals to this. which is it's not just, you know, 3 months and then they're done. This is a long stretch that would really be supportive of other businesses in the area.
Thank you. Other questions for Mayor Coleman? Mayor, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. And Chair and Representatives.
You'll be on call if we have more questions.
I'll be here.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, Mr. McGuire next. Is Mr. McGuire here? Mr. McGuire, welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you all. I'm Bill McGuire. I represent a group of local Minnesota residents who have come together to put, in fact, what is called the move to Major League Soccer for the state of Minnesota. This encompasses, and I don't want to be redundant of what's already been said, but perhaps a little history that is relevant. This encompasses going back to actually 1975 or so, which many here remember, soccer games at the Met Stadium, big crowds. There has been an on-again, off-again growth and pullback. Most recently, the professional soccer team, the Minnesota Stars, was playing in Blaine at the National Sports Center, and at the time, lacking ownership, was about to be pulled or folded into the league. We stepped forward to, what one would say, rescue the team because we felt that soccer was highly reflective of the community that we all live in, and more so the community that is in front of us, with an international flavor, the openness to all people, its immense support and enthusiasm and interest around the world, and something that we felt would make a better community for all of us. We embarked on looking around for sites for the stadium, recognizing that while Blaine had many good attributes at the National Sports Center, it was not really centrally located enough for the state and lacked some of the public transportation and other aspects that we thought were integral to allowing it to be accessible for all people. After a look 3 years ago with Mayor Coleman at the so-called bus barn site, it was concluded that nothing was going to happen there at the time. It emerged again in the last number of months as a potential, and we have embarked on doing just what has been discussed earlier. Specifically, that is to build approximately 20,000-seat professional stadium. All the money for the stadium itself being funded by the individuals that I alluded to earlier. We will turn the stadium over to the city, who will then own it, just as they do, theoretically, the XL Center CHS Field. The team ownership group is also committed to the ongoing maintenance, the sole responsibility for capital improvements and maintenance of the stadium after it starts up. It's also been discussed, of course, that there is substantive development or redevelopment and advancement, we believe, in the community around us. We are not party to that. That is private land owned by RK Midway, but we certainly are hopeful and, in fact, expecting that further vitalization of that area will occur to make this a great experience for all of the people in the community.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Questions? Representative McDonald and Hurtas.
Yeah, question. I'm not sure who this would be addressed to, but in the handout regarding the facility, regarding the 34.5 acres of the Snelling and Midway, says that more than 10 times its current taxable value after full build-out. Of course, that's good for the city. Big tax base. But currently in that area, what businesses would probably, and if any, not survive that 10 times its current taxable value?
Mr. McGuire?
Excuse me. That is, in fact, something that would be better answered by Rick Beardoff and RK Midway, the owner of the land, but I am quite facile with what's going on, so I'll make a attempt on his behalf. Right now, the developed area, so to speak, that contains some of the existing buildings amounts to about 20 acres, and it includes what some would call strip malls, Rainbow Food, Big Top Liquor, others. That is about 170,000 square feet of retail space. About 330,000 total of retail space. And I think over time, which is indeterminate but is in these bigger pictures, most if not all of that would be replaced with better, larger facilities and available for all of those tenants plus new tenants to move into the area. The actual master plan that's being submitted and has been shown to the various committees includes something around up to 2 million square feet of total space. About a fourth of that, I believe, is retail, the idea being all lower level retail and then housing and offices above it. So I think a substantive effort to bring all those people back in.
Representative McDonald?
Okay, thank you. Do you know how many mom-and-pop businesses are in those retail strip malls?
Mr. McGuire.
Right now, active tenants, maybe 20.
Representative McDonald?
Yeah, maybe I do not know what I speak of, but I'm just saying, for those mom-and-pop small businesses, their taxable value will go up significantly while this project gets a top property tax exemption for quite some time. So something to think about. If you were a business, a local liquor store, or whatever store you had, or business, your taxes are going to go up significantly for this project, which is good for the city. It creates the revenue, but certainly not good for a business that's been there and basically be forced out because of the high taxes and the property taxes, while the stadium gets a tax exemption. So just food for thought. Unless I'm incorrect, someone please correct me. But as a small businessman in Delano, I can imagine the consequences of property tax increase like that would do to a small mom-and-pop business. Maybe there's none there, so it's a moot point, but something to think about.
The continuing shifting truth about property taxes and property tax changes. Representative Moran.
Mr. President and members, I think that is that's a good point. You know, how do we allow current businesses to survive and be a part of the redevelopment? And I think there's a window of opportunity for that to happen. This is kind of like some of the same conversation that many of us and concerns that many of us, including myself, had as we were building the light rail. And, you know, within that process, there is, you know, there were some small moms and pop businesses who were not able to survive the construction of it. But within that, there was many more who found their way into the district to continue to support the community and the small businesses. So I think at some point we, you know, me and all others will be working to ensure that we can create a space that in some way that many of those small moms and pop businesses will have an opportunity to be a part of this development, if possible. That's a priority of mine.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McGuire, thank you for your testimony this morning, and thank you for not asking the legislature to build this with taxpayer money. However, we clarified a little bit earlier that, okay, this is going to be used for private use, and so therefore we need a property tax exemption. One of the difficulties I'm going to have to explain to constituents back home is, and let me give you an example. You know, any other private business, let's say I build and have a bunch of model homes around the West Metro, and I need those homes to conduct my business and to make sales and to have an economic benefit. Why shouldn't I get a property tax exemption while I'm marketing homes and doing good for the community? Why shouldn't I get a sales tax exemption to build those homes? And furthermore, that's another part of the bill, the sales tax exemption. I guess I'm curious, and nothing has choose not to want to disclose, but what kind of arrangement on the backside is going on with regard to the lease arrangement, and how long and at what terms are you getting credit for the $150 million of this proposed cost in terms of consideration of the lease agreement?
Mr. McGuire.
I think several things in there, and certainly we're very sensitive to all of us, the owners or the investors in this are very sensitive to a broad range of issues and needs for all people. The lease arrangement is over as constituted right now. We pay lease 50 years to the City of St. Paul at a rate consistent with what it is leasing from that transit, so to speak. So the city retains the land. Ultimately, we have the 50-year lease, and that's how we will pay in.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you for that. But my question was, is there being consideration given to the lease for the fact that you're donating $150 million to the city?
Dr. McGuire.
I do not believe so. I think the land value itself was established independently, and this reflects the value of carrying that land thing. But I think Mayor Coleman might be better at the detail on that than I.
Representative Hertaus?
Well, certainly over 50 years, I mean, there's going to be a considerable amount of maintenance cost to the building, not just the land. And, you know, that's going to become the burden of the taxpayer in terms of the lease and have to reflect the cost of that. So if I'm not getting something here, certainly we're looking for some explanation. But, you know, my understanding in donating the gift of building the stadium and having the property for your exclusive use, that you're leasing the property. But, you know, my presumption would be then that you'd be responsible, at least in the lease payment annually, would have to cover the cost that the city's going to, and taxpayers would bear to maintain this stadium for your use.
Mr. McGuire, and Mayor Coleman's here too.
Mr. Chairman, we are responsible for all the maintenance cost of the building and all the capital improvements, so there is no future burden on the city, the state, or anyone. We have to fund that. That is part of the agreement, and so there would be no ongoing responsibility, even though the building itself would have been turned over to the city, and that's arranged within the use agreement with the city.
Mayor Coleman?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I just want to emphasize that point, which is, I think, also another unique feature of this. That is the team's responsibility for operations and maintenance of this facility to keep it up to Major League standards and to do that. And I think that that is a particularly strong provision in the lease agreement that we have worked out with the team, or the use agreement. In addition to that, relative to the payments, the payments are for the amortized cost of the land that the Met Council currently owns the land. There's a couple of additional acre or so that needs to be acquired with the current property owner at Midway Shopping Center. But for the most part, the negotiation was between the Metropolitan Council to acquire the underlying land and then leasing that back at the amortized value, plus whatever carrying cost of the cost of the, you know, the land over the 50-year period of the lease. So that is the lease payment, and then the team is responsible for all operations and maintenance.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mayor Coleman, Dr. McGuire. That's reassuring. That makes me feel better about what this proposal is, because the general assumption would be is that you're making this improvement and then you're turning it all over to the city. So what you're leasing, if I'm understanding this correctly now, is you're just leasing the land only over 50 years.
Mr. McGuire.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay. And
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is going to be the because this is a private investment, and you're really kind of functioning as a triple net lease holder, paying the maintenance on the building. In this case, we're asking for property tax exemption on those improvements. What is the projected cost that you feel it's going to cost to build the stadium, along with all of the accoutrements that go into it?
Dr. McGuire.
Right now, we are confident that it will be $150 million or more.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Okay, so
Mr. Chair and Representative, if I could just add,
Mayor Coleman,
we should not lose the fact that there was also the private investment group had to pay $100 million for the franchise rights in addition to that. So the total private investment in this franchise is well in excess of $250 million.
That's a lot of soccer balls. Representative Hertaus.
All right. Well, I think I can end my questioning for there, but I think you know where I'm going with this, and there should certainly be a lot of concerns with the extent of what we do in the private market versus the public sector. And I think overall this will be a good project for St. Paul, and certainly is going to help grow the values of the neighborhood.
But as Representative McDonald had previously shared, and maybe he didn't quite articulate it, what I was taking from that is this increased values is going to put an added property tax burden on these small businesses, too, which might threaten their survival.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could add to that, first
Mayor
of all,
Coleman.
In Representative McDonald's defense, he's an Irishman. He's always articulate.
Okay.
Very articulate.
Very
and he doesn't take offense either.
Second of all, the current owner of Midway Shopping Center, Rick Burdoff, has worked very closely with his tenants. All of his tenants are on leases. He's not going to terminate any leases prematurely. With any of the owners of that, he's working very closely with them to make sure that there is a place in their development or the redevelopment of this site. And quite frankly, many of them are very, very excited. Some of them are nervous, of course, which is natural for any development of this sort. The Applebaum family that owns the Big Top Liquor, which is I think one of the largest liquor sales outlets in the region, came in early on shortly after we announced this proposal, and came to us and said, "We're very, very excited about it, but we want to make sure that we have a place back in this redevelopment when it happens." And I know that Mr. Burdoff has worked very closely with them, as well as the other retailers. There are a lot of national chains in there. There's drugstores, shoe stores, and others. There are a few, outlets that they're working on. So we have a jobs task force as well to figure out how we make sure that we retain jobs on the site. So we're very mindful of the potential disruption for businesses, but also mindful of coming up with solutions for that, as Representative Moran suggested.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to kind of piggyback on to that, and I understand where Mr. Representative McDonald's a little worried about the smaller businesses around there, but maybe Mayor Coleman, can you tell me how long this property has been tax-exempt?
Mayor Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the exact number of years, but it's well in excess of 50.
Okay.
Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mayor Coleman. So by putting in this investment, you're looking at 10 times the value in the surrounding properties with increased property tax recoup, which then in essence spreads the pie further and may even lower taxes on other businesses and property owners around the area.
Mayor Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly that is with any development, hopefully that is what occurs as a result of that and the increase in values. You're always mindful, and Representative Moran said this exactly right, with respect to the development of the light rail, that was a huge concern that folks would be phased out because of significant increases in property values, and we've been mindful of that as we as we look at that. But the more the values go up, and the more property there is that is now taxable, like the increased value on the site, that then gets spread out across the entire city, quite frankly. So all businesses potentially benefit as a result of that.
Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mayor Coleman. I kind of keep thinking of this as in a way, like a type of a TIF district with the but-for test and the evening out of the property once it comes back on the rolls. But that's leads me to another question. Would this, is the city have any plans, or would this kind of preclude you from using TIF to redevelop any of the other portions? Mm-hmm. Basically, the infrastructure around that area has already been upgraded with the Snelling Bridge. Do you see any more need for the infrastructure that you'd actually tap into a TIF district or not?
Mayor Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this has certainly been a conversation at the City Council level and the city level, just kind of looking at what tools might be available or needed to fully redevelop that. This is the challenge that we have in development, quite frankly, across this region. The cost of construction on Snelling and University are the same cost of constructions that you would have in downtown Minneapolis. What you can charge in rent in downtown Minneapolis is very different than what you might be able to charge for rent on the corner of University and Snelling, even with all the improvements and with the stadium. And so what we've said is, before we let's not take any tools off the table until we fully understand what the potential proposals are. But it is our commitment to, certainly we don't use TIF unless it's absolutely necessary. This isn't an existing TIF district right now. And secondarily, we we use TIF when we can for public infrastructure and public spaces. That might be streets, that might be sewer, that might be public parking, some of those things that could attract businesses, et cetera. Not to subsidize a private business owner, but to really provide for the public infrastructure needed to do the full redevelopment. So those tools are still there to the extent that we have them, and we'll be very mindful as we go forward in terms of what's actually needed.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look at this through the eyes of some of the business people I've been with and interacting down in my area. Some of them believe in the least amount of government constraints, interactions, but one of those takes advantages of every opportunity within code and present practices to their advantage when doing this type of activity. I've got a couple queries. One, I think that there will be an increased property value on some of the businesses and the impact. However, having been there yesterday, as in that within a block of the site, I think that the increased traffic and the improvement in the area may offset some of that burden. I couldn't guess. But we talk TIF, and this is TIF-like. Every time I've seen TIF and a business activity, I've seen one town versus another town, bidding off, in other words, to get. And I don't think this quite fits in that, but were there other sites that would not have involved this that were looked at? And, maybe tell us why this site was chosen and give us a broader picture, because I'm not objecting to the improvement to this area. I think it's great, and I'm not objecting to a businessman taking advantage of what options there are. I just want a bigger picture of what options were there and why we're at this point.
Mr. McGuire?
Yes. Originally, as I said, the singular site that we were thinking about was this site, and that was some 3.5 years ago, when there were some hearings with Met Council about the property. That not being available, we ultimately looked at probably 30 sites, potentially out farther central. The three preeminent ones were probably near the Mall of America on the east side. A second one was in the Farmers Market area of downtown Minneapolis. And then the third one was this. And in the end, all of these were less looking for a business opportunity, frankly, and more of what will best serve the constituents, the people, the fans, this highly diverse group of people, the younger people that are building our communities for the future. And so public transportation and accessibility became one of the biggest factors in ease of access. We settled back on this one when, in fact, Mayor Coleman, Met Transit came forward and said there is a possibility to now do something here.
Members, we're running short on time here. Representative Quama has another question, but I've got four on the list. What I'd like to do is have Representative Quam finish here, and then we've got some other testifiers. We want to be sure to get through them, and I think Mr. McGuire and the mayor will still be in attendance if we can get to all of those questions. Representative Quam.
I must say that there being a light rail station right there hopefully would increase the paid ridership, and there'd be additional revenue. When I was very young, I did attend a Kix, I believe was the name of it, some years ago.
That was a cereal, Representative Quam.
Yes, a tasty cereal. But the I attended that, and it hasn't been 50 years. What happens to the stadium if 10, 15 years down the line things change, and does the facility itself then go to the city? Just trying to understand the long-term impacts.
Mayor Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the fact of the matter is soccer is in a very, very different place than it was back in the 70s and 80s, and I always say I used to go to the parking lot of a lot of Kicks games. I'm not sure I always made it into the games.
What were you doing there, Mayor?
There was a good tailgating scene out there, but the fact of the matter is, you know, there was a lot of excitement back then, but since then we've had multiple generations of kids growing up playing soccer. I spent way too many hours and weeks and months and years of my life watching soccer, youth soccer, and coaching youth soccer. The increase in the fan base across the country, the success of teams like in Portland and Seattle and Kansas and across the country, positioned this league very differently. And I think that quite frankly, as the world game finally comes to the United States of America, you're seeing an incredible fan base. And so you can never predict fully what that looks like 50 years from now. But particularly given the significant increase in residents of our communities that grew up with soccer as their game, that are rabid fans, as well as the fan base and fan clubs. You know, you can see it if you go to Brits at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning to watch English Premier League. You know, that's, I think, that an example of how this game is on the ascent, while others may be, you know. Now, hopefully the Wild will, you know, have a run, and then we'll get back talking about hockey too, but we'll see.
And Miss Dr. McGuire.
And the final part of it, once the stadium is complete early 2018, at that point it will be turned over to the city. It will not be sometime in the future.
Okay, thank you. I do have Representatives Anderson, Whalen, Vogel, and Dabney on the list, but we do need to get to these testifiers, and hopefully we'll have time to fit everything in. Dr. McGuire and Mayor, thank you, and please stay tuned.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
In the interest of time, you can take me off the list. I'll have another swing at these folks tomorrow in full committee.
Okay, Representative Dabney, thank you. Next up we have Ms. Is it Croton?
Creighton.
Welcome to the Property Taxes Committee. Thanks for coming today. If you could give us your name and kind of where you're from, and then please proceed.
Hi, my name is Derek Creighton. I am 13 years old, and I attend St. Louis Park Middle School. My favorite thing to do is play soccer with my friends at Joy of the People in St. Paul. It will be right down the street from the new stadium, and I'm looking forward to walking to a game with my friends after practice. Soccer is a game for everyone. It's played by the whole world, and it's our universal language. Putting in a Major League Soccer team and building a new stadium will bring Minnesota together to watch the beautiful game.
Thank you, Ms. Creighton. Is there any questions for her? Thanks for spending your morning with us today. You aren't skipping school, are you? Okay, we won't report you in. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, check in with Representative Erickson on your way out. Okay. Ms. Donnelly. Welcome to the Property Taxes Committee, Ms. Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a tough act to follow, so I'll do my best and keep it very brief. My name is Julia Donnelly. I'm the political director for the Operating Engineers Local 49. We represent 13,000 heavy equipment operators working in Minnesota's construction industry. Furthermore, I'm a resident of the Union Park neighborhood. I live four blocks from this site. And additionally, I'm also on the Snelling Midway Community Advisory Committee, which is advising on planning and development on the entire site. The building trades are extremely excited about this opportunity to put our members to work. This is $150 million in private investment, equals about 1,900 construction jobs. Equally important, again, as the mayor had mentioned, the stadium is serving as a catalyst for future development. And as a resident of this area and a representative of the workers that are going to build the stadium, we urge your support on both provisions. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Donnelly. Members, questions for Ms. Donnelly? Okay, thank you. Mr. I'll let him say his last name. I'm going to guess Tholouis?
Tholouis. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Good morning.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Hi. I'm Gat Tholouis. I sit on the board of the Minnesota Youth Soccer Association. The MYSA is a nonprofit organization which for about 50 years has been dedicated to providing a safe and fun environment for youth soccer in the state of Minnesota. We represent some 70,000 kids and 13,000 adults. Our players come from all over Minnesota, as far as Alexandria, Albert Lee, Duluth, Bemidji, Marshall. Youth soccer participation in the state of Minnesota is the largest of youth sports. While other major sport experience a decline in participation, our numbers continue to rise. However, like every sport in the U.S., where some 70% of kids give up sport at age 14, we are not immune to this decline. While there are a number of factors that contribute to that decline, we've chosen to focus on the experience of the young player in their preteen years and the passion we give those kids and as a retention form for kids in our programs. Our main focus is the enjoyment and passion of the game in these early years. Our relationship with Minnesota Youth United provides us with a significant avenue to build and deepen those passions and alignments for the game, the city of St. Paul, and the state of Minnesota. Similar to other communities where professional sports teams have defined and united communities, example Boston Red Sox, Chicago and the Bulls, Dallas and their Cowboys, with the huge diversity within our state, professional soccer, a game which crosses every demographic, would only help to unite our communities. Europeans, South Americans, Latin American, Africans, Asian, male and female all participate in our sport and make up the 70,000 kids we represent. We see the introduction of Major League Soccer as a great avenue for the membership to experience what their parents had the same with their parents and their grandchildren growing up in communities with professional soccer. The end result is that we create a deep passion for the game and increase the number of kids who continue to participate and retain their admission for the game. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thulawi. Sir, would you like to speak as well?
Sure.
Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself and proceed.
Chris Ferguson. I'm on the executive committee of the Midway Chamber of Commerce, which represents businesses up and down University Avenue. We have about 320 or so members along University Avenue in the community immediately surrounding the proposed stadium site. I'm a business owner myself. I own two businesses on Washington Avenue. I've been heavily involved in the Green Line and supporting the businesses and understanding the issues related to both growing businesses and helping them survive the construction periods and then ultimately growing jobs after those construction periods are through. I think our sense is in this development, it's not just about building a soccer stadium. I think if that was solely what it was, there might be some different thoughts. It's really about making a catalytic investment on a corridor, a Green Line corridor, and in an area of St. Paul that could really use a lot of good-paying jobs for the communities and the people that live along this corridor. I think from a small business perspective, you have a significant increase in traffic. Our businesses are on the other end of the corridor down by Stadium Village. We've had more development in Stadium Village, a few billion dollars of development, which has led to significant increases in traffic for the small businesses in the area and allowed them, post-construction of the light rail, to really come back strong, even though many of them had 20, 30, 40% drops in revenue during construction. So tax increases are one thing, but I think it's important to note that for most small businesses, taxes are not the number one line item in their P&L. So if they can grow their revenue, they can manage the business part of it, and have the increase in traffic flow that you would have from a soccer stadium, the 2,000 square feet of new retail development, commercial development, and housing in the area, that would be a fair increase for most people, and I think you'd have a lot of people looking to come into the area and be part of that development from a retail perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Questions for Mr. Thulawi or Mr. Ferguson, members? Thank you both. Anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Please come up, sir. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Brian Corset. I live at 1549 Ashland, which is about a half a mile south of the Midway Stadium site and the bus park.
Could you restate your last name?
Sure. Corset, Q-U-A-R.
Corset. Okay. Thank you.
So I have a disclosure to make. First of all, I'm a huge soccer fan, right? I saw my first game in 1976 with the Minnesota Kicks. Admired players coming from England like Alan Willey and Alan Merrick and South African Ace Netselengwe. It was an introduction to me to the international
to having international friends as I started to play and coach for almost 20 years. And most recently, in the last 10 years, I'm known actually throughout the U.S. as a soccer writer that's from this area that covers the game. But I'm not going to talk to you today about, I know it sounds odd, but I'm not going to talk to you from the soccer side. Yes, I'd like a soccer stadium there. But I'm going to talk to you as a resident that's also on Union Park District Council. I live in Merriam Park as well, Union Park District Council Land Use Committee, who have done sat on for years on committees that working around the bus barn site on the super block and what was going to be done with that site as it sat vacant for so long. I even run a Facebook page called Citizens for a Better Snelling Avenue, which talks about the vibrancy, trying to get local businesses, small businesses, promoting them, walkability, bikeability. And a year ago, when I heard that the stadium was going to be built at that site, or it was a possibility, I wasn't for it. I even went public on a public forum and made a post about it. And the reason why is I had been involved for quite a while about that super block, looking at it, trying to figure out what we could do with it, and really very little had become of it. Finally, Rick Beardoff, who owns the property, Arcade Midway, owns 200 properties across the U.S., he had subdivided part of it so he could try to redevelop along Snelling Avenue, and even that plan fell flat on its face. So I was short-sighted. I saw the stadium in there by itself and thought, this isn't a very good fit. What I learned in talking to, in doing articles and talking to Dr. McGuire, talking to Mayor Coleman, talking to Rick Beardoff, the owner of the land, is that this is kind of a package deal. I don't think, I know Dr. McGuire didn't want to put the stadium down there unless the whole area was redeveloped. I know that Rick Beardoff has told me that he did not want the stadium there unless the whole area was redeveloped, and he's been waiting for a catalyst to make that happen. Even MLS probably wasn't interested in a stadium being there unless it was totally redeveloped. The interesting piece of this is that during this time and looking at the redevelopment of this whole property, we have somebody who's willing to put $250-300 million invest in my community to change this, to make it, and this is the thing, they wanted to redevelop it to make it a true transit-oriented development. And that's what the Met Council, so many meetings I sat in, Met Council, City of St. Paul, we're working on for the longest time to make this a true transit-oriented development. Light rail, bus rapid transit, it's perfect. And this is why I didn't want the stadium. Once I saw that vision, that's what they wanted as well, and they're going to put green spaces in and maintain green spaces. We have so little in our neighborhoods. We'll have retail. There'll be, hopefully businesses there that will be good-paying jobs. So I'm just here today just to tell you that, if you look at that property, I forget who was just said they were over there just the other day, looking at that property, it's a blighted a sea of asphalt right now. And the bus barn site, I've been driving by it since I was a little boy. For 20 years it sat vacant. It's an eyesore to the community. It's sitting empty. Nobody's wanted to build on it. And they store old buses and shelters on it and staging constructions in the middle of a close to neighbors or to neighborhoods, to houses. So, I ask that you consider this very seriously. This is a great thing that could happen, not only for young urban millennials, for first and second generation immigrants that love this game, for soccer fans, but for the neighborhoods in general and what it can do for them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Korsted. Members, for questions for Mr. Korsted. Thank you, sir. Members, Mr. Hines put together a spreadsheet for us. I asked him to put together kind of an outline of what the impact would be in terms of property tax shifts, in terms of fiscal disparities, and some of the other questions that members might have. Mr. Hines, can you kind of give us a quick 1 or 2 minute walk through this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is the one-page sheet that
in your folder that looks like this. And just briefly, I just took an assumption of $150 million stadium, talked to a few experts who suggested that the taxable value of that investment would probably in the range of 30 to 50% of the total. I just picked 40%, which gets us to $60 million. The currently exempt land is worth about $6.5 million, so I got to a taxable value of land that would be or a property being exempted under this bill, and this is when it would be fully developed, at about $66 million. So just sort of tracing how that would fall through the system, the first little block there, and I did this kind of hurriedly, so it's not maybe laid out quite as clearly as it could be, but how much, so because it's commercial industrial in the metro area, of course only 60% of the value stays with the city, 40% goes into the area-wide tax base. So the tax capacity that would be exempt from the local base is, you see, $800,000, which amounts to a tax of about $1.2 million is really the local taxes that are being exempted under this bill. I took traced it through the impact on a homeowner in St. Paul, which was about $11. Suburban Ramsey County through the county levy, about $3. This is per year. This is an average home in each place. And sort of just to get the effect there, then going to the next block of numbers there, that's dealing with the fiscal disparities portion, the 40% of the value. It ended up being about a 0.14% of the area-wide pool that would be not contributing, which amounts to about $800,000 of tax revenue. I did a quick run on the whole metro, and I got an impact in Anoka County, about $1 on an average home in Anoka County, being a county that tends to have people that are more dependent on fiscal disparities. The opposite end of the spectrum, Southwest Hennepin County, my regions, traced to less than a dollar. This is annual, of course. And then the final part of the property tax system in Minnesota for commercial property would be the part that's the state general levy. That would be about a $650,000 exemption there. Trace that impact through to what is the shift onto other properties in the state. $300,000 CI property is about a $2 increase in their tax burden per year. So the total of those three different components of the tax ends up being a $2.7 million, again, on this assumption about net $66 million of taxable value. So,
thank you, Mr. Hines. Mr. Hines, one of the questions, I know we've looked at the fiscal disparities thing before, and when we had the fiscal disparities discussion last session, I was really kind of shocked by the fact that the stadiums that we have now are exempted. Is there a way to keep them in the pool, even with the exemption going forward, to still keep them in the pool? And would there be a similar way to do that with the other stadiums or not? Has anybody discussed that?
So, Mr. Chairman, I think what you're suggesting is, could they be required to still pay the 40% contribution to the metro pool with their local tax being exempt? We don't have any examples of doing that under law. In some ways, you could argue that's kind of what happens with TIF, because even if a property is in place in TIF, it still has to contribute to the fiscal disparities pool. But of course, it's not really exempt when it's in TIF, but depending on how that TIF is used, it can sort of work that way. But other than that, I can't think of any other examples of a situation where you would be paying into the metro pool but not the local tax base.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, did you have comments? We're about done here, but Representative Sanders, anybody have any real pressing question, members? It's 5 minutes past. Representative Kosnick's got a quick one, and then we'll let Representative Sanders wind up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, what would be the sales tax exemption impact if they were paying the sales tax?
I think,
or maybe we can save that for tax committee, but
yeah,
just as we're going over the numbers here.
Good tax committee discussion.
Ms. Schill has the numbers at hand.
Mr. Chair and members, if you look at the table that I provided for the impacts, even though that's not the jurisdiction of this committee, I did record the sales tax exemption revenue impact, and for fiscal 2017, and that that sales tax exemption is on construction materials. You'll see the total all funds impact. There's an impact to the general fund of $1.3 million, to the natural resources and arts fund, $100,000. So $1.4 million in 17, $2.1 million in fiscal 18, and then the window closes. So it's just those 2 years.
Thank you. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Shelby. Very quick. I just was reading an article online, which could be wrong. It's from the MLS, that said that they do plan to break, that you do plan to break ground in June. And so I'm just wondering if you are planning to build with or without the sales tax and the other property tax exemptions.
Mr. McGuire.
I think the absence of the continuation of the tax exemption on the property will challenge the initiative significantly and make it very difficult.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, are you okay? Representative Hertas, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank Representative Sanders and Representative Moran, Dr. McGuire. Thanks for vetting some of the questions, because these are the things that we have to go back and answer to our respective constituents, so thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, if you want to give closing comments.
Well, sure, Mr. Chair, and I guess going back to the brief discussion that you and Mr. Hines brought up, if I look at this sheet, and I mean absolutely zero disrespect, this is not my area of expertise at all whatsoever, but for me, currently where the stadium would sit is currently property tax exempt for the most part. There are no other plans to revitalize this area. There are no other plans to recoup property taxes from this site. I think if you're going to make a decision based off of the topic you just brought up, Mr. Chair, I think we also need to have Mr. Hines do some data runs on the new property tax values, the new businesses that would be coming in, the sales tax revenue that would be coming in, and what effect that would also have on the fiscal disparities pool. If we're just doing it on this half of the equation, they're kind of more or less phantom numbers, because again, nothing right now, there is no property tax coming in off of this site where the stadium would sit. So with that, I think that we find ourselves in a very unique and I think a very positive place in being able to redevelop a site that is desolate, that has been off the property tax rolls for almost 50 years, and redevelop an area that is more or less depressing when you look at it and you drive by it right now, and add some revitalization to the area. So with that, members, I can't thank you enough for the time today and for vetting the issue, and I hope that we'll continue to have a great discussion as this bill moves forward. I think this is the way stadiums should be done if we're going to do it, and that's with private dollars building the stadium and private development happening outside of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you all. And with that, the chair does lay over House File 3806. Members, the meeting is adjourned.